Today on the 21st, an interview with war correspondent Terrell Germaine Starr. The University of Illinois journalism graduate has been reporting stories from the front lines of Russia's war in Ukraine.
We were just driving in when these missiles struck this base.
We'll talk with Starr about covering a war zone and moving through Ukraine and Russia as a Black American man. I'm Brian Mackey. That's coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been nearly 4 months since Russian leader Vladimir Putin directed his military to invade Ukraine. Thousands of people from both countries have been killed. The United Nations says more than 14 million refugees have fled Ukraine and its neighboring countries, the biggest refugee crisis since World War II. Today we're going to hear from someone who's been reporting from the front lines. Terrell Germaine Starr is an independent journalist based in Kyiv. He earned master's degrees in Russian, East European, and Eurasian studies, and in journalism from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He lived in Ukraine as a Fulbright Fellow and in the Republic of Georgia as a Peace Corps volunteer. Terrell was also an intern and student reporter at our home station, WILL, in 2008. My colleague Tanisha Spain spoke with Starr back in April, 2 months into the war. Because this conversation is on tape, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought by sending an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org, or tweet us at 21st Show. Okay, here now is Tanisha Spain speaking with Terrell Germaine Starr.
All right, so let's just jump into it. Let's get into some business here. So for the first segment, we're going to talk about what's going on now. And you've got a very big, very active, very animated Twitter following. So let's listen to some video that you tweeted in late February.
So the checkpoint where I'm at, there's a military base right across the street, and it was hit with two missiles. And so this is the damage of it right now. So the military and volunteers are working to take care of the situation right now. We were just driving in when these missiles struck this base.
Okay, so take us back to that moment, Terrell. You know, here we are sitting in a cush studio, but not too long ago, you were in a literal war zone.
Listen, I was almost hit by that strike. Me and my friend I was with, so I was embedded with a territorial defense unit. And I wanted to be a part of a unit that was part of the Army or the Marines, but you need a special pass for that. And so I didn't go to the front that was really close where the Russians were fighting, where I did. But I was able to get with the Territorial Defense Unit, who are armed volunteers. And so I was able to develop some camaraderie with those folks. And so I stayed with them a few nights. But on this particular night, my friend had forgotten something at our place because we both decided to live together during the war because we figured we would be safer. Mm-hmm. So we were at that very site. We decided to drive back to the apartment. We got what we got and returned. And about 200 meters, we were about 200 meters from the actual strike when we saw the two missiles hit. So I literally saw them streaking across the windshield, and then you heard the explosion, and then what you first see is the smoke that puffs up afterwards, and it just slowly raced towards our vehicle because obviously we slowed down.
Sure.
And then you heard the other explosions because you also have munitions and other things that are happening there. And so after about a minute or so, there are a couple things that I learned about myself. The one thing is I was actually attracted to it. Because this is the first time I covered a war mm-hmm. as a journalist, and either makes or breaks you at that moment. I immediately knew that I was attracted to the violence, more or less. And I wanted to figure out what was going on. Mm-hmm. And so after Andre said, hey, we should go forward, because we were trying to figure out if there would be more strikes, then we raced to the scene, and five people were injured. And what a lot of people don't know about missile strikes, the explosion is not necessarily what kills you. It's the shrapnel. And seriously damages you, because it goes up, right? And so that's why people duck. But I took video and captured the whole scene, and it was just really, really, it was exhilarating. And of course, you know, it was a very tragic situation because people were hurt. But as a news person, I realized that I really like being on the scene and capturing the aftermath of those things. And I realized that that type of work was something that I had the ability and capacity, the mental capacity to do.
And that's a huge responsibility, too, because if you are essentially first on the scene, the weight of telling the world what you're seeing right now, that is huge. So to say that you've got the capacity and the desire and the drive to do that, that's a tough role, and not everyone can do that.
Not everyone can do it. In reality, it's an unnatural thing. Violence at a war level shouldn't happen. That's the first thing. And you shouldn't see what happens in those types of events, because human beings shouldn't treat people. We shouldn't treat each other that way. And so for those who really can't stomach it, I think that not only is it okay, but it's normal to not be able to stomach it.
Right.
Because it's not a natural thing for a human to see. And in fact, I was the very first person on the scene. Not only national media in the United States used that video, but I also noticed that Ukrainian media used it, because I was the first person. And so in that moment, how do you do it? Because I only had my phone. A lot of people don't know that. I literally use this phone that you're looking at right now, iPhone 13 Pro, and which actually captures really good video if you know how to use the settings really well. And if you see it on television, with the exception of the lighting, you really don't know if I'm using whatever, you know, a professional camera, you know, a Canon or what. And so basically make sure that you turn it. And, you know, turn the camera properly so it could, so the video can be used on television.
Sure.
And going around, like, all those things, you think about it instantly. And a lot of people don't know, I didn't do television reporting. The first time I did live television reporting was in Ukraine during this war.
Wow. Wow. So earlier this week, you've been on campus. Well, you've been kind of doing a whirlwind tour since you touched down. But you talk to students, you talk to people about how folks on the street in Ukraine are freely sharing their thoughts and their opinions about Russia. Let's listen into that.
We'll win.
Only Ukraine will win.
Only Ukraine will win. Russians. We'll kill everybody for our land. It's our land.
Okay, guys, you see what people have to say about that.
There's right. No other way to interpret that, right?
Oh my God! So, you really dug in. You really did do your homework on this. Okay, so listen. All right, so I'll tell you how I do this. So these are man on the street videos, and so this was maybe day three of the war, and I was trying to figure out some content to produce, and I said, let me just go on the street and show people what it's like to shop for bread. It was just something really simple. It wasn't, I didn't even think of it, but I knew people would be interested in how I was living. And I really was looking for bread. I was really looking for these things. So I said, let me just take the camera and go along. And also just to show what life was like, right? Because there's a lot of normalcy and chaos often. And so a lot of people just assumed that the entirety of the country was just under flames and everything, and I wanted to show people that that wasn't true. And so there's a dichotomy of war. There's a diversity of how people live in these environments. And so I had gone to a grocery store, and I was just telling people about that. And this guy that you heard came up, and what a lot of people don't see is that he had on a Chicago Bulls hat. And then there was a Kentucky Fried Chicken billboard in the back. And so it was the most memeable image ever. And so it was this Ukrainian guy with the Chicago Bulls saying Kentucky Fried Chicken and this black dude with a selfie stick. And so whatever type of stereotypes that you can joke about, make fun of, and turn it into parody, people did it.
The ingredients were there.
And so the funniest memes that I saw was they had the parental advisory because people were saying, okay, this is a rap album. And you saw the parental advisory thing at the bottom. And then some people were saying straight out of Ukraine, and people gave us names. And so it just took a life of its own. That video got about 2.5 million views.
Wow.
I had no idea that people would be that interested in the simplicity of life. But what made it, but that's the thing. When you do a man on the street format, mm-hmm. it's very intimate.
It is.
And interact with you. And I strategically chose that. But that's part of what pulled people into my style of storytelling about what was going on.
Now, you talked about this being sort of your first foray into being a war correspondent or a war reporter. What were you doing in the days and weeks and months leading up to the conflict? And what brought you to Ukraine?
I had started visiting Ukraine as early as 2008. I earned a Fulbright fellowship in 2009 to 2010. I was there for a year and a half. And then after that point, I would go for a couple weeks here, a couple weeks there. And around 2016, I decided, okay, I'll spend a month, then 2 months, then 3 months. Now I spend half the year. There are roughly 5 months out of the year, at least, you know. But this trip, I had planned on staying for 3 weeks, visit friends, and start a clothing business. And, you know, like a resale business, mm-hmm. and also to start a tourism business. And listen, that's not going to happen this year. The tourism is not going to happen. But once we realized that the war was imminent, I decided to stay and see what was going on. And so I had gone, you know, if you look at my Instagram especially, I was traveling all around the country, visiting people, having fun. And I had on this red, what really drew people to me also, I had this red jacket on with a fur, white fur trim. And I didn't think anything of it. I mean, as you clearly see with how I dress, I enjoy fashion. And people were calling me Santa Claus.
I saw those pictures.
And I was black
it
Santa.
Was
I
was, giving,
I,
it was given Santa.
But, you know, I bought that. And the guy, the designer of that jacket was a black man who, and I bought that in 2020. And the first time I wore it was in Ukraine. And as I was walking around, the little children said, Father Frost, Father Frost. Mm-hmm. And so parents were asking me to take photos with their children.
Oh, wow.
And so it became a thing, which I did not anticipate. So much of how I storytell, I don't even try to bring myself into the story. But there's people, what I'm aware of is that people are as interested in me as they are in the stories that I tell, and so I just combine the two.
Okay. All right, we're talking with independent journalist Terrell Jermaine Starr, if you're just joining us. He's visiting Illinois this week, taking a break, covering Russia's war in Ukraine. Terrell's also the founder and host of the Black Diplomats podcast, and we've got just a few minutes before we got to take our first break. But Terrell, I want to ask you, do you ever see a scenario where you think Ukraine would concede?
No. They'll never concede. We could talk about it after the break, but the Ukrainians are so angry and have so much built up hatred for not only Putin, but much of the Russian population, that they're at the point where they'll fight to the last civilian, whether they'll throw rocks, whether they'll fire a bullet, whether they'll throw the guns that they have after they run out of bullets. No, there's no room for concession. I don't see that happening at all.
You talked about in your Q&A session that there were older ladies, you know, seniors who have said, give me a gun. I will defend. You know, talk a little bit about that.
So they're just videos of babushkas, these old women who are saying that if I could see, I would get a gun and kill. They were, and you see these folks on local television all the time saying that I'll die on my land. I won't run away. I don't want to be a refugee. But it's, what I also hear just in my own conversations with people, and they see me as a foreigner a lot of times, so people will come up to you and just let you know how they feel. And part of it is, hey, if I had a gun, I see a Russian, I'm killing them. I'll use a Molotov cocktail. But that's the way that the the president, Volodymyr Zelensky, that's the energy that he has galvanized in the population. Every person will fight. Everyone should be prepared to fight. And that, and those words from those older women are very indicative of that call.
And we've got about a minute left here. What do you think the biggest fears that Ukrainians have about Russia occupying, or the possibility? What do you think the biggest fear there is?
Well, the occupation has been going on since 2014. The larger fear is that the world will not support them in ways that they feel will preserve their statehood. That's their biggest thing. They're not afraid of fighting. They're not afraid of even dying. What they're afraid of is the statehood, the status of their country. And they keep the messaging that I hear is, we do not want to be slaves to Russia. And my friend capped it off to me the best way possible by saying that Putin sent slaves to liberate free people. And so that's a message and an energy that is constantly repeated in the country. And so that's the main thing. They care about their statehood very much.
Okay, we're going to get back to my colleague Tanisha Spain speaking with reporter Terrell Germaine Starr, who's been covering Ukraine. This conversation was first broadcast back in April. They're going to be speaking for the rest of the program today, but first, we need to take a quick break. Before we do, I want to urge you to subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. That's The 21st. You can also find a link to subscribe to our podcast on our website, which is 21stshow.org. There you can find all of our past conversations, including with a former U.S. ambassador who's a specialist in the region, and a graduate student from Central Illinois whose family fled Dnipro in eastern Ukraine in the earliest days of the war. More to come with Terrell Germaine Starr after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation on Russia's war in Ukraine with independent journalist Terrell Germaine Starr. He's based in Kyiv and has been on the front lines reporting. He has master's degrees in journalism and in Russian, East European, and Eurasian studies, both from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He was also a student reporter at our home station, Illinois Public Media, back in 2008. He's also the founder and host of the Black Diplomats podcast. My colleague Tanisha Spain spoke with him when he was visiting Illinois back in April, taking a break from covering the war, and we'll pick up from where they left off.
Let's jump back into some more questions. Let's talk about Russia and Vladimir Putin. You said that the warmongering started with a strongly worded document last summer. Tell us about that document.
Right. So Putin published an essay last summer, I believe it was in July of last year, and in which he talked about the history, the so-called history of brotherhood between Ukrainians and Russians. And the way that he was framing it is was talking about how, for more than 1,000 years, Russians and Ukrainians were one people that fought together, that were united. And the way that he worded, the whole point of the essay was really, I think he was really speaking to his people, and it was really a propaganda piece because it was very ahistorical and it was full of lies, and basically saying that we were never enemies, and saying that the West is pretty much dividing us, because in reality Ukrainians are Russians. So according to his logic, right, and so you are an off branch of who we are, and it was basically saying that you really, there is really no Ukrainian state. There is a Russian state. And so you have broken away from us, and it's time for you to rejoin your family. And the Ukrainians are not going to accept this, but it wasn't worded for them. It was, even though that it was published in English, right? But it, as well as Ukrainian, and as well as in Russian, excuse me. And so the point of it was to speak to his people and justify a rhetoric that would lead up to an invasion, because as many Russians see it, it is the Ukrainians must be rejoined back with Russia, the empire that the West essentially broke up. And so this is us versus them, and us will be united when we have Ukraine back in. What's happening now is that Ukrainians have clearly shown that they do not accept this narrative. And so if you will not join us, we'll kill you. And it's not a complex formula.
Wow. Okay, we're going to go to a call. We've got Lewis calling from Herrick, Illinois. Lewis, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead with your question.
I wonder, is there any feeling or desire among the Ukrainian people to attack? I don't know whether it would be to surgically strike where Putin's at, or in Moscow, or even just to hit one of their cities on the other side of the border. I just kind of wondered if there's a desire for, you know, I don't
to
know.
Take that offensive.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Offensive.
That's a good question. So the Ukrainians don't have the bandwidth to do that, first of all, or the proper platforms. And so you're talking about cruise missiles. You're talking about Iskander missile. You know, they don't have the long range platforms to do that in any meaningful way. Also, they have more priorities inside the country, particularly with the corridor between Mariupol, which is that southern seaport that is essentially lost, right? Because there are a group of soldiers that are inside of a steel plant, and I'm pretty sure people who have been paying attention have been are aware of that. But what the Russians want, so the Ukrainians are busy making sure that that corridor is not connected from the south going into Donbass. And so because of that, in addition to the fact that the Ukrainians don't have nearly as large a military, even though that they're more professionally trained and they're better soldiers, they have a relatively smaller number of troops. So they don't have enough folks to go on an offensive like that. They do have offensive capability to fight the Russians in Donbass and Luhansk. They have that capacity. So right now the main priority is preventing the Russians from taking over more land than they already are. A lot of people don't know that the Russians have not completely taken over the entirety of the Luhansk and Donbass regions. They have large portions of it, but not the entirety of it. And so that's their priority, and they don't have enough space and bandwidth to do anything else, really.
Okay. Lewis, thank you so much for that call. Great question. And a reminder to listeners, we would love for you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 800-222-9455. So let's move into some recent news. Actually, just about an hour ago, recently, President Biden asked for $800 million for more military support. Two questions here. Do you feel like, you know, with this news that the U.S. is doing enough, and what will this $800 million, you know, do you think it would, I don't want to say make a difference, but truly make a difference?
Yes, as far as $800 million, yes, it will definitely make a difference. And so one of the things that's really helping the ground troops to really do so well, just to give you some context, as of now, according to the Ukrainian government, more than 20,000 Russian soldiers have been killed in Ukraine. And so let's just say that number is a bit exaggerated. Let's say that it's even 15,000. That's still an astronomically high number mm-hmm. of dead by any standard. And mm-hmm. so the Ukrainians at the ground level are winning. What's helping with that are Javelin missile systems, you know, anti-tank platforms that has been assisting. And so that was one of the major holes in the amongst a number of things. In 2014, that prevented the Ukrainians from fending off a Russian offensive. And so they've been busting hundreds of Russian tanks. And so that's been very helpful. That's going to be a part of that package, ammunition. And so in order to fight a military that size, you definitely need all the ammo, all the hardware that's in that package. Is America doing enough? It depends on what you're saying by enough. So the current sanctions regime that the United States, along with our European partners, have right now, if you were to score it on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say that it's a 7.5. Okay. It needs to be a full 10. And why is it a 10? It's because the energy sector in Russia, oil and gas exports, have not been hit hard. And that's more of a European Union mm-hmm. thing, because they rely on Russian gas. In some instances, in the case of Germany, 60% of their gas needs are fulfilled by Russia. And even if the European Union decided that today that they would cease using Russian oil, from an infrastructure perspective, it would take a year and a half to 2 years for them to fully convert, because a lot of people think that you just turn up the switch and it doesn't work that way.
Right.
You have to create infrastructures, all of those things. It takes political plan. It's a whole thing, and depending on where you're going to get it from. And so, but until the energy sector is hit, then, Russia is such a huge country. It's not Iran. It's not South Africa. It's not any of these smaller nations. It is a country with multiple time zones and sanctions. There's a way in which that Russia can absorb them in ways that most countries cannot.
Something smaller. Wow.
Because it's an art. I'll cap it off by saying that sanctions are an art, not a science. You have to be very specific about what you're targeting, and it's very it's up for interpretation of whether or not they're working.
Okay.
Which I think they are in this case, but anyway.
So as you're moving around in a war zone, what type of equipment do you carry? You mentioned your selfie stick and your iPhone, but what else are you carrying around out there?
Oh, listen, a bulletproof vest and a helmet and common sense. That's the main thing that you need, is common sense. Because, one of the main things that you have to walk in with is that no story is worth your life. And I told you earlier that I was attracted to the violence. And a lot of people don't admit that. And I think that many people who do this type of reporting, they are attracted to it. They're just not admitting it. Because it takes a particular type of mind.
Sure.
It really, and I think it's just okay to say that everyone can't do it. But the main thing is, none of this is worth your life. And the reason why you're covering this violence is that you have a larger story to tell. And when you realize that when it's not safe, you shouldn't be there. You think, okay, maybe I can do this stand up in downtown Kyiv as opposed to going to the front. And because, no B-roll is worth risking a bullet, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the main thing I carry around with me. But as far as practical things, it's a bulletproof vest and a helmet. And that stuff is really expensive. So I borrowed one. Mm-hmm. Now that I can get one, because people have been supporting my work so much. I mean, that whole kit between getting the best possible vest and the helmet, that's more than $1,000.
Oh, wow.
Easy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's that. And then making sure that you have multiple packs of batteries, because you don't know how long you're going to be. You don't know how long you're going to be there. Lighting, all that stuff. And so I don't know about other people, but you have to be in really decent shape. Also your clothing, waterproof, waterproof, water resistant.
Just
being ready for anything. Yeah.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about race and ethnicity, which seems to be skipped over a lot in the war discussion. So, and you talked about this the other night. How does identity play a role in this conflict?
It depends on whose identity we're talking about. So I'll start with those who are the refugees. So during the first week or so, it was extremely chaotic. No one knew what the Russian capabilities would be. No one knew that the Ukrainians would be defending the country as well as they are. And so there was this huge rush to the border. And just to let people know what the environment that we were in, you had these territorial defense units that were establishing checkpoints throughout the country. And part of that is because of saboteurs who were caught. And actually, I'll talk to you about it later, because I actually saw some people who are deemed as saboteurs shot and killed at a checkpoint. Yeah, well, we could talk about that. But just giving you some perspective, as I was helping to take some refugees out from the Kyiv area to whether it be the Polish border or the Slovakian border, we ran into more than 30 checkpoints. And so a trip that would take, let's say, 12 hours or 14 hours took 2.5 days.
Oh, my God.
And 2 nights of sleeping. And you didn't.
Sleeping in vehicles?
Wherever you can. Because the Airbnbs, where booking.com, everything was booked. And people were jacking up prices. And whatever was available, people were taking it. And so I used my social media to ask people, I'm going to be in this area. Where, can somebody give me a place to stay or this other family a place to stay? And so that's how I use my social media. And that's why it was very active. And there are a lot of Ukrainians. I mean, thousands upon thousands of Ukrainians, whether they're in the United States, or whether they're in Ukraine, follow me. And they reach out to me and say, hey, you can stay here. You can stay with me. You can do it.
So you're literally just kind of finding a place to crash in the moment.
In the moment, because you don't know where everything's going. And so I'm just, so in going to the point about the, about identity, it's not lost on me that, yes, I'm Black, but I'm a Black American. Mm-hmm. And people who are from the continent are not treated as well, no matter where you are. It's just a fact. And so I always lead with that because there are certain passport privileges that I have. And so I always center the people who are from the continent and the Black Ukrainians because I have resources that they simply do not have. I also have the passport protection that mm-hmm. they do not have. And so with a lot of the African students, I'll tell you, when I went to the border, you know, the thing about the priority, how the country is prioritizing folks was that they were making sure that the women and children are getting out first. So Ukrainian women and children, if you're a man between the ages of 18 to 60, you can't leave. And so I actually escorted families out because I have a U.S. passport. I can come and go, you know, anytime I want it across the border without a problem. And so they were trying to get all these women and children out because they're liabilities.
Sure.
And war. I mean, they just are. I mean, women, you know, the children die of malnutrition, the elderly. So you want to get them out. And so in the sincere push to get these people out, you had people at the border who, if they were racist before this conflict started, the racism came out. When you see all these Black faces coming up and trying to get out, and the worst in you comes out. And that's what happened. And so I know people personally who've shared experiences with me that the racism didn't just end at the border. The racism continues with the Ukrainian refugees that they are with,
mm-hmm.
you know, saying, you know, you're taking up space for another Ukrainian. Or if they're Black Ukrainians, they're white Ukrainians using racial slurs around them because they think that they're some Black local person until they realize that these people speak Ukrainian as well. And so it happened during the first week. And so after that, it started dying down.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the Ukrainian, and I've spoken to a number of Ukrainian officials about this, and they're saying, yeah, we knew that this happened, but we're really concerned about the Russians using this as propaganda to suggest that we're all racist. And so you had this whole dynamic going on. But if I have just 30 seconds to say something else about the refugee situation, just to tell you an irony in this. So I was carrying this white family, white Ukrainian family to the border. Twin daughters, 9 years old, mother and the grandmother. And I was in contact with a guy named Shane. This is a 2.5-day trip. A guy named Shane on the Slovak side of the border from Britain. And we get to the border. These women, mind you, this family was in a bunker for 3 days because of bombing. Because, you know, that's where the Russians were really, really mm-hmm. close. So they were following me around, and me and my friend Andre, who was driving like ducks. And when we got to the border, they could have gone across by themselves, but they didn't want to because they were terrified.
They didn't feel safe.
So they asked me to escort them to across the border. And, you know, it was a thing where you had a moment where you're thinking, okay, I'm sure I'm the first person, Black person, that she spent any significant time with. And she's looking
and here
at
we
me
are.
For the safety, right? And so when we get across the border, we meet Shane, who was a Black British man. And so at both ends, a Black man took them all across the country to that border, and then another Black man received them. And both of us are from countries that were former slave states.
Wow. An aha moment for sure.
I'm sure that
resonated with you.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce this conversation. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, but we're listening back to my colleague, Tanisha Spain, when she spoke with the independent journalist, Terrell Germaine Starr, back in April. Starr is a graduate of the University of Illinois. He's an independent journalist based in Kyiv, and he was back visiting Illinois. She spoke with him at that time. More from their conversation after a short break. Because this is on tape, we're not taking calls, but we do love hearing what you thought about our program. Send an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Or you can always get in touch with us in real time on Twitter @21stshow. That's @21stshow. More to come. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're listening back to our hour-long conversation with journalist Terrell Germain Starr. He's been on the front lines reporting on Russia's war against Ukraine. He has master's degrees in Russian, East European, and Eurasian studies and in journalism from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He was also a student reporter at our home station, WILL Illinois Public Media, back in 2008. Just a note, he first spoke with my colleague Tanisha Spain back in April. There have obviously been a lot of developments in the war since that time, but we're going to hear about his background and his predictions about the conflict from 2 months in. Let's get back to that conversation.
So you are an independent reporter. Let's talk about what that affords you and maybe what that costs. Is it all it's cracked up to be? Is it what are your thoughts on being independent in this specific context?
So being an independent journalist covering a war is easily the hardest thing that you can do in journalism, because the risks are higher. And by any standard, you need more resources. For me, I was very fortunate that that thousands of people supported me financially during the first few weeks of the war. And I also have a business mindset. So I don't just don't see myself as a journalist. I see myself as a businessman. And so this is not the only way that I generate money for myself. And journalism is not my only piece of bread and butter. And so I have other ways that I'm thinking about how to monetize my talents and my interests. And so for me, is it all that's cracked up to be? For me, it is, because I like my ability to use my voice. Mm-hmm. And no one can tell me what to do. I don't have anyone managing me, and I love that. And it works for me, because it takes a mindset in order to do that type of work. And for some people, that may not work best for them. But if you're independent, if you like your voice and don't like being managed, then it works out for you just fine.
And speaking of using your voice, you made this tweet on March 23rd. I'm going to read it. It says, "I am Black, queer, and Christian. I'm used to whites discounting my words and Christians and Black folks saying my identity is a disease of white supremacy and a sin, so I get it from all sides." So how does that identity then creep into your journalism?
Because I think it's important to lead with who you are. I've often said this, that the genesis of American journalism has too often functioned as the white man's diary. And what do I mean by that? I mean that there's no such thing as objectivity. I think there's a such thing as fairness and accuracy and being correct. And if there are any biases, you'd be very clear about that. And so I think everyone leads with who they are. It just may not be explicit. It's always implicit. And it's implicit by who is interviewed, who is considered to be a source. I'm just a bit more open about what my process looks like. And I think that everyone needs to lead with who they are, because I think that it helps with better storytelling. And also, it's a difference between being someone like me, who's a combination of journalist and commentary, versus somebody that's working at the AP and they have a very specific mission and purpose. And so you have to get in where you fit in. I've done that for myself, but I think it's equally important for people to understand the news that they're consuming and curate the type of personalities and sources appropriately. I have a particular type of storytelling that works well for me, where I lead with my identity, and I think that helps explain things better. Because if it wasn't for that, I think the following that I have would not be nearly as numerous, because they're coming to me because I draw parallels that they understand, and my identity is a part of making that understanding clear.
Now, has that ever put you in any sort of danger, leading with who you are as a person? Does that ever, do you feel like it boxes you in, or maybe exposes you to danger?
I don't know if it definitely does not expose me to danger. It exposes me to controversy that people make up. It exposes, and I say make up because I don't see anything controversial about being who I am and clear about that. This is journalism, but it's a business. I understand very well how I traffic. Everything that I do is intentional. What I wear is intentional. Mm-hmm. How I dress is intentional. How I tweet is intentional. There is a purpose behind it. And there'll be some people who say, well, is this a journalist's role? And I would say it's my role as a journalist, and I am not the only source that you should follow. And if you need a particular type of journalism to get you a particular type of news storytelling, then you can appreciate what I do.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and then if you need something else, you go to this person at ABC, you go to CBS, where this person is a bit more traditional, doesn't have an opinion about anything at all. And so you curate it that way. But I've gotten people all the time asking me about, is this the role of a journalist by you being who you are and by you doing things that you do and tweeting how you tweet? And I simply say, it is for me.
Let's talk about your upbringing in Detroit. You talked about that at your Q&A earlier this week. Mm-hmm. How does a black boy who grew up in Detroit grow up as a war correspondent in Russia?
So, as I said, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, largest black city in the United States, and I also went to a historically black college, from Leonard Smith College in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I enjoyed my black life, had no interest of living any other life than my black existence. I mean, I just enjoyed it, and I didn't, you know, it was one, and also it's one of those things where, you know, it just reminds me of a movie, be more succinct, but at any rate, I'll just simply say that I just never thought about anything else than just being a black person, and I was fine with that. Now, I went to Russia somewhere before my senior year. I applied for a volunteer program. Application asks you, where would you like to go? I chose all the black places, acceptance letter said Russia. I had a lot of nerve and told these people that they made a mistake, that I don't want to go there. And I was very determined, because I said they made a mistake, because I am not going to any of these places. But in reality, I was a really scared 21-year-old young man, and I ended up going. It was the best decision of my life. My godmother encouraged me to go, and I did it. And because, I mean, she admonished me, because she went down a whole laundry list of how black my life was. And what I found out after going to Russia and then going into the Peace Corps at the country of Georgia was that this is where God meant for me to be. This is my talent. And I want to show other people of color, not just black people, that sometimes our best gifts are things that we don't think are germane to our culture. And I'm telling you, if you would have told me that as a 14-year-old kid growing up on the west side of Detroit, that I'll be here talking to you about Ukraine and how I lived there and how I love the culture, I would have told you that you were out of your mind. And
well, let's talk about that. How did you come to fall in love with the culture?
I had an open mind. So when I went to Russia, my mind is relatively closed. And I was afraid.
I love that you can admit that, because a lot of people won't.
Well, it's the truth. I was closed-minded. And I went in with a number of ignorance, and I had a lot of ignorance going in. And I didn't have the best experience that I could have had, because my mind was closed. And the reason why I decided to give it a go again was because I did a Peace Corps. I said, you know what? My mind was closed in this go-around, but when I go to Peace Corps, my mind's going to be completely open. And as soon as I opened up my mind, the possibilities came roaring in. And so the more I opened up my mind and my heart, and now you also just have to admit what you like.
Sure.
You know, because I was one of those people that didn't want to admit that I enjoy being around these quote-unquote white faces and things. But I did. I enjoy being this anomaly. I enjoy, you know, and that doesn't mean I don't advocate for more people of color. I actually am mentoring, you know, and working with people of color to kind of come into the field. But I feel like I'm in my zone. What I thought would make me uncomfortable, I opened up my mind and made me feel extremely comfortable. And I was in my zone, because I feel like I'm meant to be here. It's my talent, it's my skill. But I opened up my mind because I realized the opportunities that came and just acknowledged my happiness.
We've got a call real quick we're going to take from Linda Marengo. Linda, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, go ahead with your question.
Yes, I have a question for the journalist. How is he being received by the people in Ukraine? Are they kind toward him? Are they suspicious of him? Are they thankful at all for his being there and witnessing what is happening? And also, are they, because sexual orientation is such a unfortunately huge topic in this country, Are they aware of his sexual orientation? Do they care about it? I'm just wondering how he's received.
Okay.
That's a good question. Thank you for asking that question. I'm received fine, right? And so as far as, you know, because I know as far as the, I'll get to sexual identity, I'll get into the racial component. No, I haven't had any problems. I'll tell you the reason why I haven't had any problems is because, and that goes back to the thing of being open-minded and just not being, you know, being ignorant. And so if you want to look for a problem, you can definitely find one. And I made a decision a long time ago that if I'm going to be in this field, I'm not going to let every little thing piss me off. Have I run into racism? Absolutely, I have. Was it so bad to the point where I felt unsafe? Absolutely not. The vast majority of Ukrainians love what I do. I get messages every single day, dozens of them saying, thank you for what you're doing for my country. We should make you an honorary Ukrainian. So it's been overwhelmingly positive. And I get this from elected officials who tell me this as well. So everything is very positive. Sexual orientation. It's interesting when you talk about that, because I felt, you know, and I know the tweets were talking about me talking about being queer. So I'll be honest with you, I'm still working through that. And I think, and the reason why I tweet that is I think it's important for black men to kind of open up and talk about how they feel and what they're exploring. And so I don't talk about it much, not because I'm afraid to. It's just, one, I'm still working through it. Those tweets are there and they're there. But has it been a problem for me? Because for a lot, you know, maybe because outwardly, you know, I'm not perceived, you know, to be queer or anything like that. So it has not caused me any problems in ways that it causes other people. But to be honest with you, I think because I'm 41 years old and I'm still working through it, and I don't, you know, it's because that may have a lot to do with it. Now, I'll tell you one thing. There, the people who have been impacted have been trans people leaving the country who don't have their proper IDs, and they have IDs that were given that recognize their marker, their gender marker that they were assigned at birth. So it's more of a trans person issue going across the border. But as for me, it hasn't been a problem at all.
I want to ask you, and thank you so much for that call. I want to ask, we've got about 3.5 minutes left.
Well, how do you? Fast,
it didn't it?
God.
Didn't it? It always does when
wow.
You're having fun.
Yeah.
How do you predict this is going to wrap up? And I know this is a loaded question. We've only got a few minutes, but what are you seeing here? What are you, from having eyes there, how do you think this is going to end?
The Ukrainians are not going to give up. They don't have any incentive. They say that the more we have 20,000 Russians dead, we'll kill 40,000 more Russians, and they're ready to fight to the death. They're not going to concede. So I don't know how it's going to end. I don't know how it's ultimately going to end exactly, but what I do know will be a part of that ending will be carnage and more death on both sides, because the Ukraine, and that's going to be, even if it takes years, because Ukrainians will not give up. It's real simple.
And you mentioned, you said several times that Ukraine is your second home. Tell us a little bit about what you love about Ukraine.
I like hiking across the Carpathian Mountains. I'm going back this summer to take an advanced Ukrainian language course, and I have a cabin there, and the Western Ukraine is relatively safe, so I enjoy the mountain views from my balcony, and I hope that one day I could buy something in that part of the world, in that part of the country, and I'm looking for, and even as I'm thinking about it right now, and I'm looking forward to going on my weekend hikes, and that's what I love about it the most, and going to Western Ukraine so I could wear all this flat clothing that people don't know about.
Yes, I'll have to check out your
Twitter. That's just for me, you know, and I like showing people, so that's what I love about it.
Excellent. Man, this hour went so fast. What a great discussion we had today. Thank you so much for coming on. Really, really appreciate it.
Two black folks on at the air at the same time.
Who would have thought?
Come up, who would have
thought?
We come a long way, didn't we? There you go. Mama would be proud. There you go.
Our special guest today has been journalist Terrell Jermaine Starr. He's visiting campus, taking a break from covering Russia's invasion of Ukraine. He's also the founder and host of the Black Diplomats podcast. Very active on Twitter. You got to check him out. And also an alum of University of Illinois and our host station, Illinois Public Media.
All right. Thank you to my colleague, Tanisha Spain, for speaking with Terrell Jermaine Starr. That conversation was first broadcast back in April. And that's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st is produced by Erica Scalise and Aiden Choate. Our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll be back with a live broadcast on Tuesday. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.